She hadn't wanted to play her music so that he'd hear it and be distracted. "If we're going to go, let's go," he said. He looked at the TV and then went to the set and turned it off. "I'm going," she said. "Just let me go to the bathroom." She closed the magazine and got up. "Hold your old horses, dear," she said and smiled. She left the room. He went to make sure the back door was locked and the porch lamp on, then came back to stand in the living room. It was a 10-minute drive to the community center, and he could see they were going to be late for the first game. He liked to be on time, which meant a few minutes early, so he'd have a chance to say hello to people he hadn't seen since last Friday night. He liked to joke with Frida Parsons as he stirred sugar into his styrofoam cup of coffee. She was one of the club women who ran the bingo game on Friday nights and during the week worked behind the counter of the town's only drugstore. He liked getting there with a little time to spare, so he and Edith could get their coffee from Frida and take their places at the last table along the wall. He liked that table. They'd occupied the same places at the same table every Friday night for months now. The first Friday night that he'd played bingo there, he'd won a $40 jackpot. He'd told Edith afterwards that now he was hooked forever. "I've been looking for another vice," he'd said and grinned. Dozens of bingo cards were piled on each table, and you were supposed to pick through and find the cards you wanted, the cards that might be winning cards. Then you sat down, scooped a handful of white beans from the bowl on the table, and waited for the game to get underway. For the head of the women's club, stately, white-haired Eleanor Bender, to commence turning her basket of numbered poker chips and begin calling numbers. That's the real reason you had to get there early, to get your place and pick out your particular cards. You had cards you favored and even felt you could recognize from week to week. Cards whose arrangements of numbers seemed more inviting than those of other cards. Lucky cards, maybe. All of the cards had code numbers printed in the upper right-hand corner, and if you'd won a bingo on a certain card in the past, or even come close, or if you just had a feeling about certain cards, you got there early and went through the piles of cards for your cards. You started referring to them as your cards, and you'd look for them from week to week. Edith finally came out of the bathroom. She had a puzzled expression on her face. There was no way they were going to be on time.
"What's the matter?" he said. "Edith?"
"Nothing," she said. "Nothing." "Well, how do I look, Jimmy?"
"You look fine. Lord, we're just going to a bingo game," he said. "You know about everybody there anyway."
"That's the point," she said. "I want to look nice."
"You look nice," he said. "You always look nice. Can we go now?"
There seemed to be more cars than usual parked on the streets around the center. In the place where he normally parked, there was an old van with psychedelic markings on it. He had to keep going to the end of the block and turn.
"Lots of cars tonight," Edith said.
"There wouldn't be so many if we'd gotten here earlier," he said.
"There'd still be as many, we just wouldn't have seen them," she corrected, teasing. She pinched his sleeve.
"Edith, if we're going to play bingo, we ought to try to get there on time," he said. "First rule of life is get where you're going on time."
"Hush," she said. "I feel like something's going to happen tonight. You watch and see. We're going to hit jackpots all night long. We're going to break the bank," she said.
"I'm glad to hear it," he said. "I call that confidence."
He finally found a parking space near the end of the block and turned into it. He switched off the engine and cut the lights.
"I don't know if I feel lucky tonight or not. I think I felt lucky earlier this evening for about 5 minutes when I was doing Howard's taxes, but I don't feel very lucky right now. It's not lucky if we have to start out walking half a mile just to play bingo."
"You stick close to me," she said. "We'll do fine."
"I don't feel lucky," he said. "Lock your door."
They began walking. There was a cold breeze and he zipped the windbreaker to his neck. She pulled her coat closer. He could hear the surf breaking on the rocks at the bottom of the cliff down behind the community center. She said,
"I'll take one of your cigarettes, Jimmy, before we get inside."
They stopped under the street lamp at the corner. The wires supporting the old street lamp swayed in the wind, and the light threw their shadows back and forth over the pavement. He could see the lights of the center at the end of the block. He cupped his hands and held the lighter for her. Then he lit his own cigarette.
When are you going to stop? He said.
When you stop, she said. When I'm ready to stop.
Maybe just like when you are ready to stop drinking. I'll just wake up some morning and stop. Like that. Like you.
Then I'll find a hobby.
I can teach you to knit, he said.
I guess I don't think I have the patience for that, she said. Besides, one knitter in the house is enough.
He smiled. He took her arm and they kept walking. When they reached the steps in front of the center, she threw down her cigarette and stepped on it. They went up the steps and into the foyer. There was a sofa in the room, along with a scarred wooden table and several folding chairs. On the walls of the room hung old photographs of fishing boats and a naval vessel, a frigate from before the First World War that had capsized off the point and been driven ashore onto the sandy beaches below the town. One photograph that always intrigued him showed a boat turned upside down on the rocks at low tide, a man standing on the keel and waving at the camera. There was a sea chart in an oak frame, and several paintings of pastoral scenes done by club members, rugged mountains behind a pond and a grove of trees, and paintings of the sun going down over the ocean. They passed through the room, and he took her arm again as they entered the hall. Several of the club women sat to the right of the entrance behind a long table. There were 30 or so other tables set up on the floor, along with folding chairs. Most of the chairs were filled. At the far end of the hall was a stage where Christmas programs were put on, and sometimes amateur theatrical productions. The bingo game was in progress. Eleanor Bender, holding a microphone, was calling numbers. They didn't stop for coffee, but walked quickly along the wall toward the back, toward their table. Heads bent over the tables. No one looked up at them. People watched their cards and waited for the next number to be called. He headed them toward their table, but tonight, starting out the way it had already, he knew someone would have their places, and he was right. It was a couple of hippies, he realized with a start, a man and a young woman, a girl, really. The girl had on an old faded jeans outfit, pants and jacket, and a man's denim shirt, and was wearing rings and bracelets and long dangling earrings that moved when she moved. She moved now, turned to the long-haired fellow in the buckskin jacket beside her and pointed at a number on his card, then pinched his arm. The fellow had his hair pulled back and tied behind his head, and a scruffy bunch of hair on his face. He wore little steel-frame spectacles and had a tiny gold ring in his ear.
Jesus, James said and stopped.
He guided them to another table.
Here's two chairs. We'll have to take these places and take our chances. There's hippies in our place.
He glared over in their direction. He took off his windbreaker and helped Edith with her coat. Then he sat down and looked again at the pair sitting in their place. The girl scanned her card as the numbers were called. Then she leaned over next to the bushy fellow and looked his cards over as if, James thought, she were afraid he might not have sense enough to mark his own numbers. James picked up a stack of bingo cards from the table and gave half to Edith.
Pick some winners for yourself, he said. I'm just going to take these first three on top. I don't think it matters tonight which cards I choose. I don't feel very lucky tonight, and there's nothing I can do to change the feeling. What the hell's that pair doing here? They're kind of off their beaten path, if you ask me.
Don't pay them any attention, Jimmy, she said. They're not hurting anybody. They're just young, that's all.
This is regular Friday night bingo for the people of this community, he said. I don't know what they want here.
They want to play bingo, she said, or they wouldn't be here. Jimmy, dear, it's a free country. I thought you wanted to play bingo. Let's play, shall we? Here, I've found the cards I want.
She gave him the stack of cards, and he put them with the other cards they wouldn't use in the center of the table. He noticed a pile of discards in front of the hippie. Well, he'd come here to play bingo, and by God, he was going to play. He fished a handful of beans from the bowl. The cards were 25 cents each, or three cards for 50 cents. Edith had her three. James peeled a dollar from a roll of bills he kept for this occasion. He put the dollar next to his cards. In a few minutes, one of the club women, a thin woman with bluish hair and a spot on her neck, he knew her only as Alice, would come around with a coffee can, picking up quarters, dollar bills, dimes, and nickels, making change from the can when necessary. It was this woman, or another woman named Betty, who collected the money and paid off jackpots. Eleanor Bender called I-25, and a woman at a table in the middle of the room yelled, "Bingo!" Alice made her way between the tables. She bent over the woman's card as Eleanor Bender read out the winning numbers.
"It's a bingo," Alice said.
"That bingo, ladies and gentlemen, is worth $12, Eleanor Bender said. "Congratulations to you." Alice counted out some bills for the woman, smiled vaguely, and moved away.
"Get ready now," Eleanor Bender said. "Next game in 2 minutes. I'll set the lucky numbers in motion right now."
She began turning the basket of poker chips. They played 4 or 5 games to no purpose. Once James was close on one of his cards, one number away from a bingo, but Eleanor Bender called 5 numbers in succession, none of them his, and even before someone else in the hall had found the right number and called out, he knew she wouldn't be calling the number he needed. Not for anything, he was convinced, would she have called his number.
"You were close that time, Jimmy," Edith said. "I was watching your card."
"Close doesn't count," he said. "It may as well have been a mile. She was teasing me, that's all."
He turned the card up and let the beans slide into his hand. He closed his hand and made a fist. He shook the beans in his fist. Something came to him about a kid who'd thrown some beans out of a window. It had something to do with a carnival or a fair. A cow was in there, too, he thought. The memory reached to him from a long way and was somehow disturbing.
"Keep playing," Edith said. "Something's going to happen. Change cards, maybe."
"These cards are as good as any others," he said. "It just isn't my night, Edith, that's all."
He looked over at the hippies again. They were laughing at something the fellow had said. He could see the girl rubbing his leg under the table. They didn't seem to be paying attention to anyone else in the room. Alice came around collecting money for the next game. But just after Eleanor Bender had called the first number, James happened to glance in the direction of the hippies again. He saw the fellow put a bean down on a card he hadn't paid for, a card that was supposed to be with the discard pile. But the card lay so that the fellow could see it and play along with his other cards. Eleanor Bender called another number, and the fellow placed another bean on the same card. Then he pulled the card over to him with the intention of playing it. James was amazed at the act. Then he got mad. He couldn't concentrate on his own cards. He kept looking up to see what the hippie was doing. No one else seemed to have noticed.
"James, look at your cards," Edith said. "Watch your cards, dear. You missed number 34. Here."
She placed one of her beans on his number.
"Pay attention, dear."
"That hippie over there who has our place is cheating. Doesn't that beat all?" James said. "I can't believe my eyes."
"Cheating? What's he doing?" she said. "How's he cheating at bingo, Jimmy?"
She looked around, a little distracted, as if she'd forgotten where the hippie was sitting.
"He's playing a card that he hasn't paid for," he said. "I can see him doing it. My God, there's nothing they won't stop at. A bingo game. Somebody ought to report him."
"Not you, dear. He's not hurting us," Edith said. "One card more or less in such a room full of cards and people. Let him play as many cards as he wants. There are some people here playing 6 cards."
She spoke slowly and tried to keep her eyes on her cards. She marked a number.
"But they've paid for them," he said. "I don't mind that. That's different. This damned fellow is cheating, Edith."
"Jimmy, forget it, dear," she said. She extracted a bean from her palm and placed it on a number. "Leave him alone. Dear, play your cards. You have me confused now and I've missed a number. Please play your cards."
"I have to say it's a hell of a bingo game when they can get away with murder," he said. "I resent that, I do."
He looked back at his cards, but he knew he might as well write this game off. The remaining games as well, for that matter. Only a few numbers on his cards had beans.
There was no way of telling how many numbers he'd missed, how far behind he'd fallen. He clenched the beans in his fist. Without hope, he squeezed a bean out onto the number just called, G60. Someone yelled, "Bingo!"
"Christ," he said.
Eleanor Bender said they would take a 10-minute break for people to get up and move around. The game after the break would be a blackout, $1 a card, winner take all. This week's pot, Eleanor announced, was $98. There was whistling and clapping. He looked over at the hippies. The fellow was touching the ring in his ear and looking around the room. The girl had her hand on his leg again. "I have to go to the bathroom," Edith said. "Give me your cigarettes. Maybe you'd get us one of those nice raisin cookies we saw, and a cup of coffee."
"I'll do that," he said. "And by God, I am going to change cards. These cards I'm playing are born losers."
"I'll go to the bathroom," she said. She put his cigarettes into her purse and stood up from the table. He waited in line for cookies and coffee. He nodded at Frida Parsons when she made some light remark, paid, then walked back to where the hippies were sitting. They already had their coffee and cookies. They were eating and drinking and conversing like normal people. He stopped behind the fellow's chair.
"I see what you're doing," James said to him.
The man turned around. His eyes widened behind his spectacles.
"Pardon me?"
he said, and stared at James.
"What am I doing?"
"You know,"
James said. The girl seemed frightened. She held her cookie and fixed her eyes on James.
"I don't have to spell it out for you," James said to the man. "A word to the wise, that's all. I can see what you're doing."
He walked back to his table. He was trembling. Damn all the hippies in this world, he thought. It was enough of an encounter so that it made him feel he'd like to have a drink. Imagine wanting to drink over something happening at a bingo game. He put the coffee and cookies down on the table. Then he raised his eyes to the hippie who was watching him. The girl was watching him too. The hippie grinned. The girl took a bite of her cookie. Edith came back. She handed him the cigarettes and sat down. She was quiet. Very quiet. In a minute, James recovered himself and said,
"Is there anything the matter with you, Edith? Are you all right?"
He looked at her closely.
"Edith, has something happened?"
"I'm all right," she said and picked up her coffee. "No, I guess I should tell you, Jimmy. I don't want to worry you, though." She took a sip of her coffee and waited. Then she said, "I'm spotting again."
"Spotting?" he said. "What do you mean, Edith?"
But he knew what she meant. That at this age and happening with the kind of pain she'd said it did, it might mean what they most feared.
"Spotting,"
he said quietly. "You know," she said, picking up some cards and beginning to sort through them. "I'm menstruating a little."
"Oh dear," she said. "I think we should go home. I think we'd better leave," he said. "That isn't good, is it?"
He was afraid she wouldn't tell him if the pain started. He'd had to ask her before, watching to see how she looked. She'd have to go in now. He knew it. She sorted through some more cards and seemed flustered and a little embarrassed.
"No, let's stay," she said after a minute. "Maybe it's nothing to worry about. I don't want you to worry. I feel all right, Jimmy," she said.
"Edith."
"We'll stay," she said. "Drink your coffee, Jimmy. It'll be all right, I'm sure. We came here to play bingo," she said and smiled a little.
"This is the worst bingo night in history," he said. "I'm ready to go anytime. I think we should go now."
"We'll stay for the blackout, and then it's just 45 minutes or so. Nothing can happen in that time. Let's play bingo," she said, trying to sound cheerful.
He swallowed some coffee.
"I don't want my cookie," he said. "You can have my cookie."
He cleared away the cards he was using and took two cards from the stack of bingo cards that weren't in use. He looked over angrily at the hippies as if they were somehow to blame for this new development. But the fellow was gone from the table and the girl had her back to him. She had turned in her chair and was looking toward the stage.
They played the blackout game. Once he glanced up and the hippie was still at it, playing a card he hadn't paid for. James still felt he should call the matter to someone's attention, but he couldn't leave his cards, not at a dollar a card. Edith's lips were tight. She wore a look that could have been determination or worry. James had 3 numbers to cover on one card and 5 numbers on another card, a card he'd already given up on, when the hippie girl began screaming,
"Bingo, bingo, bingo, I have a bingo!"
The man clapped and shouted with her.
"She's got a bingo, she's got a bingo, folks, a bingo!"
He kept clapping. Eleanor Bender herself went to the girl's table to check her card against the master list of numbers. Then she said,
"This woman has just won herself a $98 jackpot. Let's give her a round of applause. Let's hear it for her."
Edith clapped along with the rest of the players, but James kept his hands on the table. The hippie fellow hugged the girl. Eleanor Bender handed the girl an envelope.
"Count it if you want to," she said with a smile.
The girl shook her head.
"They'll probably use the money to buy drugs," James said.
"James, please," Edith said. "It's a game of chance. She won fair and square."
"Maybe she did," he said. "But her partner there is out to take everyone for all he can get."
"Dear, do you want to play the same cards again?" Edith said. "They're about to start the next game."
They stayed for the rest of the games. They stayed until the last game was played, a game called Progressive. It was a bingo game whose jackpot was increased each week if no one had bingoed on a fixed amount of numbers. If no one had hit a bingo when the last number was called, that game was declared closed and more money, $5, was added to the pot for the next week's game, along with another number. The first week the game had started, the jackpot was $75 and 30 numbers. This week, it was $125 and 40 numbers. Bingos were rare before 40 numbers had been called, but after 40 numbers, you could expect someone to bingo at any time. James put his money down and played his cards without any hope or intention of winning. He felt close to despair. It wouldn't have surprised him if the hippie had won this game. When the 40 numbers had been called and no one had cried out, Eleanor Bender said,
"That's bingo for tonight. Thank you all for coming. God bless you, and if he's willing, we'll see you again next Friday. Good night, and have a nice weekend."
James and Edith filed out of the hall along with the rest of the players, but somehow they managed to get behind the hippie couple, who were still laughing and talking about her big jackpot. The girl patted her coat pocket and laughed again. She had an arm around the fellow's waist under his buckskin jacket, fingers just touching his hip.
"Let those people get ahead of us, for God's sake," James said to Edith. "They're a plague."
Edith kept quiet, but she hung back a little with James to give the couple time to move ahead.
"Good night, James. Good night, Edith," Henry Culkin said.
Culkin was a graying, heavyset man who'd lost a son in a boating accident years before. His wife had left him for another man not long afterwards. He'd turned to serious drinking after a time and later wound up in AA, where James had first met him and heard his stories. Now he owned one of the 2 service stations in town and sometimes did mechanical work on their car.
"See you next week."
"Night, Henry," James said. "I guess so, but I feel pretty bingoed out tonight."
Culkin laughed.
"I know just exactly what you mean," he said and moved on.
The wind was up, and James thought he could hear the surf over the sound of automobile engines starting. He saw the hippie couple stop at the van.
He might have known. He should have put 2 and 2 together.
The fellow pulled open his door and then reached across and opened the door on the woman's side. He started the van just as they walked by on the shoulder of the road. The fellow turned on his headlamps, and James and Edith were illumined against the walls of the nearby houses.
"That dumbbell," James said.
Edith didn't answer. She was smoking and had the other hand in her coat pocket. They kept walking along the shoulder. The van passed them and shifted gears as it reached the corner. The street lamp was swinging in the wind. They walked on to their car. James unlocked her door and went around to his side. Then they fastened the seatbelts and drove home. Edith went into the bathroom and shut the door. James took off his windbreaker and threw it across the back of the sofa. He turned on the TV and sat down and waited. In a little while, Edith came out of the bathroom. She didn't say anything. James waited some more and tried to keep his eyes on the TV. She went to the kitchen and ran water. He heard her turn off the faucet. In a minute, she came to the kitchen doorway and said,
"I guess I have to see Dr. Crawford in the morning, Jimmy. I guess something's happening down there."
She looked at him. Then she said,
"Oh, damn it. Damn it. The lousy, lousy luck."
And began to cry.
"Edith," he said and moved to her.
She stood there shaking her head. She covered her eyes and leaned into him as he put his arms around her. He held her.
"Edith, dearest Edith," he said.
"Good Lord."
He felt helpless and terrified. He stood with his arms around her. She shook her head a little.
"I think I'll go to bed, Jimmy. I am just exhausted. And I really don't feel well. I'll go to see Dr. Crawford first thing in the morning. It'll be all right, I think, dear. You try not to worry. If anyone needs to worry tonight, let me. Don't you? You worry enough as it is. I think it'll be all right," she said and stroked his back. "I just put some water on for coffee, but I think I'll go to bed now. I feel worn out. It's these bingo games," she said and tried to smile.
"I'll turn everything off and go to bed too," he said. "I don't want to stay up tonight either, no sir."
"Jimmy, dear, I'd rather be alone right now if you don't mind," she said. "It's hard to explain. It's just that right now I want to be alone. Dear, maybe that doesn't make any sense. You understand, don't you?"
"Alone," he repeated.
He squeezed her wrist. She reached up to his face and held him and studied his features for a minute. Then she kissed him on the lips. She went into the bedroom and turned on the light. She looked back at him, and then she shut the door. He went to the refrigerator. He stood in front of the open door and drank tomato juice while he surveyed its lighted interior. Cold air blew out at him. The little packages and cartons of foodstuffs on the shelves, a chicken covered in plastic wrap, the neat foil-wrapped bundles of leftovers, all of this suddenly repelled him. He thought for some reason of Alice, that spot on her neck, and he shivered. He shut the door and spit the last of the juice into the sink. Then he rinsed his mouth and made himself a cup of instant coffee, which he carried into the living room where the TV was still playing. It was an old Western. He sat down and lit a cigarette. After watching the screen for a few minutes, he felt he'd seen the movie before, years ago. The characters seemed faintly recognizable in their roles, and some of the things they said sounded familiar, as things to come often did in movies you'd forgotten. Then the hero, a movie star who'd recently died, said something, asked a hard question of another character, a stranger who'd just ridden into the little town, and all at once things fell into place, and James knew the very words that the stranger would pick out of the air to answer the question. He knew how things would turn out, but he kept watching the movie with a rising sense of apprehension. Nothing could stop what had been set in motion. Courage and fortitude were displayed by the hero and the townsmen turned deputies, but these virtues were not enough. It took only one lunatic and a torch to bring everything to ruin. He finished the coffee and smoked and watched the movie until its violent and inevitable conclusion. Then he turned off the set. He went to the bedroom door and listened, but there was no way of telling if she was awake. At least there was no light showing under the door. He hoped she was asleep. He kept listening. He felt vulnerable and somehow unworthy. Tomorrow she'd go to Dr. Crawford. Who knew what he would find? There'd be tests. Why Edith, he wondered. Why us? Why not someone else? Why not those hippies tonight? They were sailing through life free as birds, no responsibilities, no doubts about the future. Why not them, then, or someone else like them? It didn't add up. He moved away from the bedroom door. He thought about going out for a walk, as he did sometimes at night, but the wind had picked up, and he could hear branches cracking in the birch tree behind the house. It'd be too cold anyway, and somehow the idea of a solitary walk tonight at this hour was dispiriting. He sat in front of the TV again, but he didn't turn on the set. He smoked and thought of the way the hippie had grinned at him across the room. That sauntering, arrogant gait as he moved down the street toward his van, the girl's arm around his waist. He remembered the sound of the heavy surf, and he thought of great waves rolling in to break on the beach in the dark at this very minute. He recalled the fellow's earring and pulled at his own ear. What would it be like to want to saunter around like that fellow sauntered? A hippie girl's arm around your waist. He ran his fingers through his hair and shook his head at the injustice. He recalled the way the girl looked as she yelled her bingo, how everyone had turned enviously to look at her in her youth and excitement. If they only knew, she and her friend. If he could only tell them. He thought of Edith, in there in bed, the blood moving through her body, trickling, looking for a way out. He closed his eyes and opened them. He'd get up early in the morning and fix a nice breakfast for them. Then, when his office opened, she would call Dr. Crawford, set a time for seeing him, and he would drive her to the office and sit in the waiting room and page through magazines while he waited. About the time Edith came out with her news, he imagined that the hippies would be having their own breakfast, eating with appetite after a long night of lovemaking. It wasn't fair. He wished they were here now in the living room, in the noontime of their lives. He'd tell them what they could expect. He'd set them straight. He would stop them in the middle of their arrogance and laughter and tell them. He'd tell them what was waiting for them after the rings and bracelets, the earrings and long hair, the loving. He got up and went into the guest room and turned on the lamp over the bed. He glanced at his papers and account books and at the adding machine on his desk and experienced a welling of dismay and anger. He found a pair of old pajamas in one of the drawers and began undressing. He turned back the covers on the bed at the other end of the room from his desk. Then he walked back through the house, turning off lights and checking doors. For the first time in 4 years, he wished he had some whiskey in the house. Tonight would be the night for it, all right. He was aware that twice now in the course of this evening he had wanted something to drink, and he found this so discouraging that his shoulders slumped. They said in AA never to become too tired or too thirsty or too hungry, or too smug, he might add. He stood looking out the kitchen window at the tree shaking under the force of the wind. The window rattled at its edges. He recalled the pictures down at the center, the boats going aground on the point, and hoped nothing was out on the water tonight. He left the porch lamp on. He went back to the guest room and took his basket of embroidery from under the desk and settled himself into the leather chair. He raised the lid of the basket and took out the metal hoop with the white linen stretched tight and secured within the hoop. Holding the tiny needle to the light, he threaded the eye with one end of the blue silk thread. Then he set to work where he'd left off on the floral design a few nights before. When he'd first stopped drinking, he'd laughed at the suggestion he'd heard one night at AA from a middle-aged businessman who said he might want to look into needlework. It was, he was told by the man, something he might want to do with the free time he'd now have on his hands, the time previously given over to drinking. It was implied that needlework was something he might find good occupation in day or night, along with a sense of satisfaction. "Stick to your knitting," the man had said and winked. James had laughed and shaken his head. But after a few weeks of sobriety, when he did find himself with more time than he could profitably employ, and an increasing need for something to do with his hands and mind, he'd asked Edith if she'd shop for the materials and instruction booklets he needed. He was never all that good at it. His fingers were becoming increasingly slow and stiff. But he had done a few things that gave him satisfaction after the pillowcases and dishcloths for the house. He'd done crocheting, too, the caps and scarves and mittens for the grandchildren. There was a sense of accomplishment when a piece of work, no matter how commonplace, lay finished in front of him. He'd gone from scarves and mittens to create little throw rugs which lay on the floor of every room in the house now. He'd also made two woolen ponchos which he and Edith wore when they walked on the beach, and he'd knitted an afghan, his most ambitious project to date, something that had kept him busy for the better part of 6 months. He'd worked on it every evening, piling up the small squares, and had been happy with the feeling of regular industry. Edith was sleeping under that afghan right now. Late nights he liked the feel of the hoop, its taut holding of the white cloth. He kept working the needle in and out of the linen, following the outline of the design. He tied little knots and clipped off little bits of thread when he had to. But after a while he began to think about the hippie again, and he had to stop work. He got mad all over again. It was the principle of the thing, of course. He realized it hadn't helped the hippie's chances, except maybe by a fraction, just by cheating on a single card. He hadn't won, that was the point, the thing to bear in mind. You couldn't win, not really, not where it counted. He and the hippie were in the same boat, he thought, but the hippie just didn't know it yet. James put the embroidery back into the basket. He stared down at his hands for a minute after he did so. Then he closed his eyes and tried to pray. He knew it would give him some satisfaction to pray tonight, if he could just find the right words. He hadn't prayed since he was trying to kick the drink, and he had never once imagined then that the praying would do any good. It just seemed to be one of the few things he could do under the circumstances. He'd felt at the time that it couldn't hurt anyway, even if he didn't believe in anything, least of all in his ability to stop drinking. But sometimes he felt better after praying, and he supposed that was the important thing. In those days he'd prayed every night that he could remember to pray. When he went to bed drunk, especially then, if he could remember, he prayed. And sometimes just before he had his first drink in the morning, he prayed to summon the strength to stop drinking. Sometimes, of course, he felt worse, even more helpless and in the grip of something most perverse and horrible, after he'd say his prayers and then find himself immediately reaching for a drink. He had finally quit drinking, but he did not attribute it to prayer, and he simply hadn't thought about prayer since then. He hadn't prayed in 4 years. After he'd stopped drinking, he just hadn't felt any need for it. Things had been fine since then. Things had gotten good again after he'd stopped drinking. 4 years ago, he'd awakened one morning with a hangover, but instead of pouring himself a glass of orange juice and vodka, he decided he wouldn't. The vodka had still been in the house, too, which made the situation all the more remarkable. He just didn't drink that morning, nor that afternoon or evening. Edith had noticed, of course, but hadn't said anything. He shook a lot. The next day and the next were the same. He didn't drink, and he stayed sober. On the fourth day in the evening, he found the courage to say to Edith that it had been several days now since he'd had a drink. She had said simply, "I know that, dear." He remembered that now, the way she'd looked at him and touched his face, much in the manner she'd touched his face tonight. "I'm proud of you," she'd said, and that was all she'd said. He started going to the AA meetings, and it was soon after that that he took up needlework. Before the drinking had turned bad on him, and he'd prayed to be able to stop, he'd prayed on occasions some years before that, after his youngest son had gone off to Vietnam to fly jet planes. He'd prayed off and on then, sometimes during the day if he thought about his son in connection with reading something in the newspaper about that terrible place, and sometimes at night lying in the dark next to Edith, turning over the day's events, his thoughts might come to rest on his son. He'd pray then, idly, like most men who are not religious pray. But nevertheless, he'd prayed that his son would survive and come home in one piece. And he had returned safely, too, but James hadn't ever for a minute really attributed his return to prayer. Of course not. Now he suddenly remembered much farther back to a time when he'd prayed hardest of all, a time when he was 21 years old and still believed in the power of prayer. He'd prayed one entire night for his father that he would recover from his automobile accident. But his father had died anyway. He'd been drunk and speeding and had hit a tree, and there was nothing that could be done to save his life. But even now, he still remembered sitting outside the emergency room until sunlight entered the windows and praying for his father, making all kinds of promises through his tears, if only his father would pull through. His mother had sat next to him and cried and held his father's shoes, which had unaccountably come along in the ambulance beside him when they'd brought him to the hospital. He got up and put his basket of embroidery away for the night. He stood at the window. The birch tree behind the house was fixed in the little area of yellow light from the back porch lamp, the treetop lost in the overhead darkness. The leaves had been gone for months, but the bare branches switched in the gusts of wind. As he stood there, he began to feel frightened. And then it was on him, a real terror welling in his chest. He could believe that something heavy and mean was moving around out there tonight, and that at any minute it might charge or break loose and come hurtling through the window at him. He moved back a few steps and stood where a corner of light from the porch lamp caused the room to brighten under him. His mouth had gone dry. He couldn't swallow. He raised his hands toward the window and let them drop. He suddenly felt he had lived nearly his whole life without having ever once really stopped to think about anything, and this came to him now as a terrible shock and increased his feeling of unworthiness. He was very tired and had little strength left in his limbs. He pulled up the waist of his pajamas. He barely had energy to get into bed. He pushed up from the bed and turned off the lamp. He lay in the dark for a while. Then he tried praying again, slowly at first, forming the words silently with his lips, and then beginning to mutter words aloud and to pray in earnest. He asked for enlightenment on these matters. He asked for help in understanding the situation. He prayed for Edith, that she would be all right, that the doctor wouldn't find anything seriously wrong, not, please, not cancer. That's what he prayed for strongest. Then he prayed for his children, two sons and a daughter, scattered here and there across the continent. He included his grandchildren in these prayers. Then his thoughts moved to the hippie again. In a little while, he had to sit up on the side of the bed and light a cigarette. He sat on the bed in the dark and smoked. The hippie woman, she was just a girl, not much younger or different looking than his own daughter. But the fellow, him and his little spectacles, he was something else. He sat there for a while longer and turned things over. Then he put out his cigarette and got back under the covers. He settled onto his side and lay there. He rolled over onto his other side. He kept turning until he lay on his back, staring at the dark ceiling. The same yellow light from the back porch lamp shone against the window. He lay with his eyes open and listened to the wind buffet the house. He felt something stir inside him again, but it was not anger this time. He lay without moving for a while longer. He lay as if waiting. Then something left him and something else took its place. He found tears in his eyes. He began praying again, words and parts of speech piling up in a torrent in his mind. He went slower. He put the words together, one after the other, and prayed. This time he was able to include the girl and the hippie in his prayers. Let them have it, yes, drive vans and be arrogant and laugh and wear rings, even cheat if they wanted. Meanwhile, prayers were needed. They could use them too, even his, especially his, in fact. If it please you, he said in the new prayers for all of them, the living and the dead. So much water, so close to home. My husband eats with good appetite, but seems tired, edgy. He chews slowly, arms on the table, and stares at something across the room. He looks at me and looks away again, and wipes his mouth on the napkin. He shrugs, goes on eating. Something has come between us, though he would like to believe otherwise.
What are you staring at me for?
He asks.
What is it?
He says and lays his fork down. Was I staring?
I say and shake my head stupidly, stupidly. The telephone rings.
Don't answer it,
he says. It might be your mother, I say. Dean, it might be something about Dean.
Watch and see, he says.
I pick up the receiver and listen for a minute. He stops eating. I bite my lip and hang up.
What did I tell you?
He says. He starts to eat again, then throws the napkin onto his plate.
God damn it, why can't people mind their own business? Tell me what I did wrong and I'll listen. It's not fair. She was dead, wasn't she? There were other men there besides me. We talked it over and we all decided. We'd only just got there. We'd walked for hours. We couldn't just turn around. We were 5 miles from the car. It was opening day. What the hell? I don't see anything wrong. No, I don't. And don't look at me that way, do you hear? I won't have you passing judgment on me. Not you.
You know, I say and shake my head.
What do I know, Claire? Tell me. Tell me what I know. I don't know anything except one thing. You hadn't better get it worked up over this.
He gives me what he thinks is a meaningful look.
She was dead, 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 do you hear?
He says after a minute.
It's a damn shame, I agree. She was a young girl and it's a shame and I'm sorry as anyone else, but she was dead, Claire, dead. Now let's leave it alone. Please, Claire. Let's leave it alone now.
That's the point, I say. She was dead, but don't you see? She needed help.
I give up,
he says and raises his hands. He pushes his chair away from the table, takes his cigarettes, and goes out to the patio with a can of beer. He walks back and forth for a minute and then sits in a lawn chair and picks up the paper once more. His name is there on the first page, along with the names of his friends, the other men who made the grisly find. I close my eyes for a minute and hold on to the drain board. I must not dwell on this any longer. I must get over it, put it out of sight, out of mind, etc., and go on. I open my eyes. Despite everything, knowing all that may be in store, I rake my arm across the drain board and send the dishes and glasses smashing and scattering across the floor. He doesn't move. I know he has heard. He raises his head as if listening, but he doesn't move otherwise. Doesn't turn around to look. I hate him for that, for not moving. He waits a minute, then draws on his cigarette and leans back in the chair. I pity him for listening, detached, and then settling back and drawing on his cigarette. The wind takes the smoke out of his mouth in a thin stream. Why do I notice that? He can never know how much I pity him for that, for sitting still and listening and letting the smoke stream out of his mouth. He planned his fishing trip into the mountains last Sunday, a week before the Memorial Day weekend. He and Gordon Johnson, Mel Dorn, Vern Williams. They play poker, bowl, and fish together. They fish together every spring and early summer, the first 2 or 3 months of the season, before family vacations, Little League baseball, and visiting relatives can intrude. They are decent men, family men, responsible at their jobs. They have sons and daughters who go to school with our son Dean. On Friday afternoon, these 4 men left for a 3-day fishing trip to the Natchez River. They parked the car in the mountains and hiked several miles to where they wanted to fish. They carried their bedrolls, food and cooking utensils, their playing cards, their whiskey. The first evening at the river, even before they could set up camp, Mel Dorn found the girl floating face down in the river, nude, lodged near the shore against some branches. He called the other men and they all came to look at her. They talked about what to do. One of the men, Stuart didn't say which, perhaps it was Vern Williams, he is a heavyset, easy man who laughs often. One of them thought they should start back to the car at once. The others stirred the sand with their shoes and said they felt inclined to stay. They pleaded fatigue, the late hour, the fact that the girl wasn't going anywhere. In the end, they all decided to stay. They went ahead and set up the camp and built a fire and drank their whiskey. They drank a lot of whiskey. And when the moon came up, they talked about the girl. Someone thought they should do something to prevent the body from floating away. Somehow, they thought that this might create a problem for them if she floated away during the night. They took flashlights and stumbled down to the river. The wind was up, a cold wind, and waves from the river lapped the sandy bank. One of the men, I don't know who, it might have been Stuart, he could have done it, waded into the water and took the girl by the fingers and pulled her, still face down, closer to shore, into shallow water, and then took a piece of nylon cord and tied it around her wrist and then secured the cord to tree roots. All the while, the flashlights of the other men played over the girl's body. Afterwards, they went back to camp and drank more whiskey. Then they went to sleep. The next morning, Saturday, they cooked breakfast, drank lots of coffee, more whiskey, and then split up to fish, two men upriver, two men down. That night, after they had cooked their fish and potatoes and had more coffee and whiskey, they took their dishes down to the river and washed them a few yards from where the girl lay in the water. They drank again, and then they took out their cards and played and drank until they couldn't see their cards any longer. Vern Williams went to sleep, but the others told coarse stories and spoke of vulgar or dishonest escapades out of their past, and no one mentioned the girl until Gordon Johnson, who'd forgotten for a minute, commented on the firmness of the trout they'd caught and the terrible coldness of the river water. They'd stopped talking then, but continued to drink until one of them tripped and fell, cursing against the lantern, and then they climbed into their sleeping bags. The next morning they got up late, drank more whiskey, fished a little as they kept drinking whiskey, and then, at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, Sunday, a day earlier than they'd planned, decided to leave. They took down their tents, rolled their sleeping bags, gathered their pans, pots, fish, and fishing gear, and hiked out. They didn't look at the girl again before they left. When they reached the car, they drove the highway in silence until they came to a telephone. Stuart made the call to the sheriff's office while the others stood around in the hot sun and listened. He gave the man on the other end of the line all of their names. They had nothing to hide. They weren't ashamed of anything. And agreed to wait at the service station until someone could come for more detailed directions and individual statements. He came home at 11 o'clock that night. I was asleep, but woke when I heard him in the kitchen. I found him leaning against the refrigerator drinking a can of beer. He put his heavy arms around me and rubbed his hands up and down my back, the same hands he'd left with 2 days before, I thought. In bed, he put his hands on me again and then waited, as if thinking of something else. I turned slightly and then moved my legs. Afterwards, I know he stayed awake for a long time, for he was awake when I fell asleep. And later, when I stirred for a minute, opening my eyes at a slight noise, a rustle of sheets, it was almost daylight outside, birds were singing, and he was on his back smoking and looking at the curtained window. Half asleep, I said his name, but he didn't answer. I fell asleep again. He was up that morning before I could get out of bed, to see if there was anything about it in the paper, I suppose. The telephone began to ring shortly after 8 o'clock.
"Go to hell,"
I heard him shout into the receiver. The telephone rang again a minute later, and I hurried into the kitchen.
"I have nothing else to add to what I've already said to the sheriff. That's right."
He slammed down the receiver. "What is going on?" I said, alarmed.
"Sit down,"
he said slowly. His fingers scraped against his stubble of whiskers.
"I have to tell you something. Something happened while we were fishing."
We sat across from each other at the table, and then he told me. I drank coffee and stared at him as he spoke. I read the account in the newspaper that he shoved across the table. Unidentified girl, 18 to 24 years of age. Body 3 to 5 days in the water. Rape a possible motive. Preliminary results show death by strangulation. Cuts and bruises on her breasts and pelvic area. Autopsy. Rape pending further investigation.
"You've got to understand," he said. "Don't look at me like that. Be careful now, I mean it. Take it easy, Claire."
Why didn't you tell me last night? I asked.
I just didn't. What do you mean?
He said. You know what I mean, I said.
I looked at his hands, the broad fingers, knuckles covered with hair, moving, lighting a cigarette now, fingers that had moved over me, into me, last night.
He shrugged. What difference does it make, last night, this morning? You were sleepy. I thought I'd wait until this morning to tell you.
He looked out to the patio. A robin flew from the lawn to the picnic table and preened its feathers.
It isn't true, I said. You didn't leave her there like that.
He turned quickly and said,
What did I do? Listen to me carefully now, once and for all. Nothing happened. I have nothing to be sorry for or feel guilty about. Do you hear me?
I got up from the table and went to Dean's room. He was awake and in his pajamas, putting together a puzzle. I helped him find his clothes and then went back to the kitchen and put his breakfast on the table. The telephone rang 2 or 3 more times, and each time Stuart was abrupt while he talked and angry when he hung up. He called Mel Dorn and Gordon Johnson and spoke with them slowly, seriously, and then he opened a beer and smoked a cigarette while Dean ate, asked him about school, his friends, etc., exactly as if nothing had happened. Dean wanted to know what he'd done while he was gone, and Stuart took some fish out of the freezer to show him.
I'm taking him to your mother's for the day, I said.
Sure,
Stuart said and looked at Dean, who was holding one of the frozen trout.
If you want to and he wants to, that is. You don't have to, you know. There's nothing wrong.
I'd like to anyway, I said.
Can I go swimming there?
Dean asked and wiped his fingers on his pants.
I believe so, I said.
It's a warm day, so take your suit, and I'm sure Grandmother will say it's okay. Stuart lighted another cigarette and looked at us.
Dean and I drove across town to Stuart's mother's. She lives in an apartment building with a pool and a sauna bath. Her name is Catherine Kane. Her name, Kane, is the same as mine, which seems impossible. Years ago, Stuart has told me, she used to be called Candy by her friends. She is a tall, cold woman with white blonde hair. She gives me the feeling that she is always judging. I explain briefly in a low voice what has happened. She hasn't yet read the newspaper, and promised to pick Dean up that evening. He brought his swimming suit, I say. Stuart and I have to talk about some things, I add vaguely. She looks at me steadily from over her glasses. Then she nods and turns to Dean, saying,
How are you, my little man?
She stoops and puts her arms around him. She looks at me again as I open the door to leave. She has a way of looking at me without saying anything. When I returned home, Stuart was eating something at the table and drinking beer. After a time, I sweep up the broken dishes and glassware and go outside. Stuart is lying on his back on the grass now, the newspaper and a can of beer within reach, staring at the sky. It is breezy but warm out and birds call. Stuart, could we go for a drive? I say, anywhere. He rolls over and looks at me and nods.
We'll pick up some beer, he says. I hope you're feeling better about this. Try to understand, that's all I ask.
He gets to his feet and touches me on the hip as he goes past.
Give me a minute and I'll be ready.
We drive through town without speaking. Before we reach the country, he stops at a roadside market for beer. I notice a great stack of papers just inside the door. On the top step, a fat woman in a print dress holds out a licorice stick to a little girl. In a few minutes, we cross Everson Creek and turn into a picnic area a few feet from the water. The creek flows under the bridge and into a large pond a few hundred yards away. There are a dozen or so men and boys scattered around the banks of the pond under the willows fishing. So much water, so close to home. Why did he have to go miles away to fish? Why did you have to go there, of all places? I say.
The Natchez? We always go there. Every year, at least once.
We sit on a bench in the sun and he opens two cans of beer and gives one to me.
How the hell was I to know anything like that would happen?
He shakes his head and shrugs as if it had all happened years ago. Or to someone else.
Enjoy the afternoon, Claire. Look at this weather.
They said they were innocent.
Who? What are you talking about?
The Maddox brothers. They killed a girl named Arlene Hubley near the town where I grew up, and then cut off her head and threw her into the Clee Ellum River. She and I went to the same high school. It happened when I was a girl.
What a hell of a thing to be thinking about, he says. Come on, get off it. You're going to get me riled in a minute. How about it now, Claire?
I look at the creek. I float toward the pond, eyes open, face down, staring at the rocks and moss on the creek bottom until I am carried into the lake where I am pushed by the breeze. Nothing will be any different. We will go on and on and on and on. We will go on even now as if nothing had happened. I look at him across the picnic table with such intensity that his face drains.
I don't know what's wrong with you, he says.
I slap him before I realize. I raise my hand, wait a fraction of a second, and then slap his cheek hard. This is crazy, I think, as I slap him. We need to lock our fingers together. We need to help one another. This is crazy. He catches my wrist before I can strike again and raises his own hand. I crouch, waiting, and see something come into his eyes and then dart away. He drops his hand. I drift even faster around and around in the pond.
Come on, get in the car, he says. I'm taking you home.
No, no, I say, pulling back from him.
Come on, he says. God damn it. You're not being fair to me, he says later in the car.
Fields and trees and farmhouses fly by outside the window.
You're not being fair to either one of us, or to Dean, I might add. Think about Dean for a minute. Think about me. Think about someone else besides yourself for a change.
There is nothing I can say to him now. He tries to concentrate on the road, but he keeps looking into the rearview mirror. Out of the corner of his eye, he looks across the seat to where I sit with my knees doubled under me. The sun blazes against my arm and the side of my face. He opens another beer while he drives, drinks from it, then shoves the can between his legs and lets out breath. He knows. I could laugh in his face. I could weep.
2.
Stuart believes he is letting me sleep this morning. But I was awake long before the alarm sounded, thinking, lying on the far side of the bed, away from his hairy legs and his thick sleeping fingers. He gets Dean off for school and then he shaves, dresses, and leaves for work himself soon after. Twice he looks into the bedroom and clears his throat, but I keep my eyes closed. In the kitchen, I find a note from him, signed Love. I sit in the breakfast nook in the sunlight and drink coffee and make a coffee ring on the note. The telephone has stopped ringing. That is something. No more calls since last night. I look at the paper and turn it this way and that on the table. Then I pull it close and read what it says. The body is still unidentified, unclaimed, apparently unmissed. But for the last 24 hours, men have been examining it. Putting things into it, cutting, weighing, measuring, putting back again, sewing up, looking for the exact cause and moment of death. And the evidence of rape. I'm sure they hope for rape. Rape would make it easier to understand. The paper says she will be taken to Keith and Keith Funeral Home pending arrangements. People are asked to come forward with information, etc. Two things are certain. One, people no longer care what happens to other people, and two, nothing makes any real difference any longer. Look at what has happened. Yet nothing will change for Stuart and me. Really change, I mean. We will grow older, both of us. You can see it in our faces already. In the bathroom mirror, for instance. Mornings when we use the bathroom at the same time. And certain things around us will change. Become easier or harder, one thing or the other. But nothing will ever really be any different. I believe that. We have made our decisions. Our lives have been set in motion, and they will go on until they stop. But if that is true, what then? I mean, what if you believe that, but you keep it covered up until one day something happens that should change something, but then you see nothing is going to change after all? What then? Meanwhile, the people around you continue to talk and act as if you were the same person as yesterday, or last night, or 5 minutes before, but you are really undergoing a crisis. Your heart feels damaged. The past is unclear. It is as if there is a film over those early years. I cannot be sure that the things I remember happening really happened to me. There was a girl who had a mother and father. The father ran a small cafe where the mother acted as waitress and cashier, who moved as if in a dream through grade school and high school, and then, in a year or two, into secretarial school. Later, much later, what happened to the time in between? She is in another town and working as a receptionist for an electronic parts firm and becomes acquainted with one of the engineers who asks her for a date. Eventually, seeing that's his aim, she lets him seduce her. She had an intuition at the time, an insight about the seduction that later, try as she might, she couldn't recall. After a short while, they decide to get married, but already the past, her past, is slipping away. The future is something she can't imagine. She smiles, as if she has a secret, when she thinks about the future. Once, during a particularly bad argument, over what she can't now remember, 5 years or so after they were married, he tells her that someday this affair, his words, this affair, will end in violence. She remembers this. She files this away somewhere and begins repeating it aloud from time to time. Sometimes, she spends the whole morning on her knees in the sandbox behind the garage playing with Dean and one or two of his friends. But every afternoon at 4 o'clock, her head begins to hurt. She holds her forehead and feels dizzy with the pain. Stuart asks her to see a doctor, and she does, secretly pleased at the doctor's solicitous attention. She goes away for a while to a place the doctor recommends. His mother comes out from Ohio in a hurry to care for the child, but she, Claire, spoils everything and returns home in a few weeks. His mother moves out of the house and takes an apartment across town and perches there, as if waiting. One night in bed, when they are both near sleep, Claire tells him that she heard some women patients at DeWitt discussing fellatio. She thinks this is something he might like to hear. She smiles in the dark. Stuart is pleased at hearing this. He strokes her arm. Things are going to be okay, he says. From now on, everything is going to be different and better for them. He has received a promotion and a substantial raise. They have even bought another car, a station wagon, her car. They're going to live in the here and now. He says he feels able to relax for the first time in years. In the dark, he goes on stroking her arm. He continues to bowl and play cards regularly. He goes fishing with three friends of his. That evening, three things happen. Dean says that the children at school told him that his father found a dead body in the river. He wants to know about it. Stuart explains quickly, leaving out most of the story, saying only that yes, he and three other men did find a body while they were fishing. What kind of a body? Dean asks. Was it a girl?
Yes, it was a girl, a woman. Then we called the sheriff.
Stuart looks at me.
What'd he say? Dean asks.
He said he'd take care of it.
What did it look like? Was it scary?
That's enough talk, I say. Rinse your plate, Dean, and then you're excused.
But what'd it look like? He persists. I want to know.
You heard me, I said. Did you hear me, Dean?
Dean.
I want to shake him. I want to shake him until he cries.
Do what your mother says,
Stuart tells him quietly.
It was just a body, and that's all there is to tell.
I am clearing the table when Stuart comes up behind and touches my arm.
His fingers burn. I start, almost losing a plate.
What's the matter with you?
He says, dropping his hand.
Tell me, Claire, what is it?
You scared me, I say.
That's what I mean. I should be able to touch you without you jumping out of your skin.
He stands in front of me with a little grin, trying to catch my eyes, and then he puts his arm around my waist. With his other hand, he takes my free hand and puts it on the front of his pants. Please, Stuart. I pull away and he steps back and snaps his fingers.
Hell with it, then,
he says.
Be that way if you want. But just remember.
Remember what? I say quickly. I look at him and hold my breath. He shrugs.
Nothing, nothing,
he says and cracks his knuckles. The second thing that happens is that while we are watching television that evening, he in his leather reclining chair, I on the couch with a blanket and magazine, the house quiet except for the television, a voice cuts into the program to say that the murdered girl has been identified. Full details will follow on the 11 o'clock news. We look at each other. In a few minutes, he gets up and says he is going to fix a nightcap. Do I want one? No, I say.
I don't mind drinking alone,
he says.
I thought I'd ask.
I can see he is obscurely hurt, and I look away, ashamed and yet angry at the same time. He stays in the kitchen for a long while, but comes back with his drink when the news begins. First, the announcer repeats the story of the four local fishermen finding the body. Then the station shows a high school graduation photograph of the girl, a dark-haired girl with a round face and full, smiling lips. Then a film of the girl's parents entering the funeral home to make the identification. Bewildered, sad, they shuffle slowly up the sidewalk to the front steps, to where a man in a dark suit stands waiting and holding the door. Then, it seems as if only a second has passed, as if they have merely gone inside the door and turned around and come out again, the same couple is shown leaving the mortuary, the woman in tears, covering her face with a handkerchief, the man stopping long enough to say to a reporter,